The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What is the purpose of sacred tribal stories?
That was how the kids were taught morals, values, a form of education, just for pleasure. The kids always want to know, well, how come? Well, why? This was a good way to explain how things came about.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Donna Houts MacArthur, who's a member of the Shoshone-Bannock people from Fort Hall, Idaho. We're talking about her book titled, When the Smoke Goes Straight Up, Grandfather's Stories. Tell me about how you made this book, where the stories came from.
Okay. Most of the stories, the majority of them, were told to me by my grandfather, Edward Edmo. And some of the others are just, you know, the stories that we've heard here at Fort Hall. And the main reason I wanted to retell the stories was my grandkids, because I thought, if I don't write them down, they're never going to know them. They know a few of them because we tell them around the campfire, little get-togethers. But the majority of them, I was afraid, are just going to be lost. Because nowadays with the iPods and the computers, they don't take the time just to listen to stories. And so my objective was, let's write them, let's save them. They're sacred. We don't want them forgotten. Let's find a way to keep them.
Well, let's hear one of the stories. Let's hear the story about how the world was made.
Okay. In the beginning, there was nothing but water. Apa, grandfather, the Great Spirit, had three sons, Bangzuku, otter, Bamosa, the muskrat, and Honey, the beaver. They did not know how deep the water was, and they would look at the water, and every now and then a bubble would rise to the surface. They were all very curious as to what was causing the bubble to come to the top of the water. Api told his sons to dive beneath the water to see what they could find. Bangzuku, otter, dove first, and being playful, he found some bengui, fish, and so he played tag with them. After a little while, he lost his breath and had to come up for air. Api asked him, "What did you find, son?" Bangzuku said, "I found some water people." Then Honey, the beaver, the middle brother, asked, "Is it my turn to dive?" He was very good looking, and he knew it. He dressed up in his finest clothes. He closed his eyes, and Api painted him with some red marks. To this day, the beaver has these markings on him as a result of being painted by Api. Honey dove down to the water people, and a young water girl stopped to look at him. She thought he was very good looking, so she winked at him. Wow! That one little wink made him feel very happy. Honey had just stopped to talk to the girl in the water. He stayed under the water until he ran out of breath. Then he had to come up for air. Api asked him, "What did you find?" Honey told him about a meeting with a young water girl. Bamosa, muskrat, said, "It's my turn to go down." His brothers called him names, teasing him and saying, "You're too little and skinny to swim deep into the water." Bamosa had been listening to his brothers, and he knew what he had to do. So he swam hard and fast down past all the water people. The water girls tried to get him to stop, but he kept going down in the water until he hit bottom. He hit the bottom so hard that he knocked himself out. Towards evening, Pamusu's little body floated to the surface. They picked him up to revive him, and on the tip of his nose was a piece of mud. Api was very satisfied and took the ball of mud from his nose. He rolled the mud in his hands, and he sang a magic song. He blew on the ball of mud with his breath. He kept blowing on the ball until it became very large. When the ball was the size that the earth is today, he quit blowing. Api then shaped the mountains, the valleys, streams, trees, animals, and all the creatures. The very last thing he created were the people like you and me.
You say in the introduction to the book that these stories were passed down from generation to generation, and the stories were the same, but each family might have their own versions. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's similar to the Indian language. From one clan or group or family group, we say the basic words, but they might have a little different accent on that word, say it just a bit different. So that's the way with the stories. The main part of the story is the same, but everybody will tell it just a little different.
And so these stories, even though they were passed down and different storytellers told them in each generation, they stayed the same generation after generation?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Was there one person in the tribe who was appointed as a storyteller?
Not usually. It was just in the family, either the grandfather, the grandmother, or whoever was helping with the kids, but the stories were to be told in the winter months, and that's how he got the name of the book. They said in the winter, when you're putting the kids to sleep, when the smoke goes straight into the air, that's the time of the year you tell the stories.
This was something you did when it was cold and dark outside.
Side, yes. Mm-hmm. And usually they said when you're putting the kids to bed, that's when they would tell the stories.
There seem to be several different kinds of stories in here. Some are morality tales, I guess we would call them. And some are just fun. They have Coyote in them, who is the trickster. And there's one story that's about Coyote wanting to marry a very attractive goose. And I wonder if you would read that one.
Yes, I'd be glad to. Ishaput Coyote makes himself a nugatna, a goose. One nice, sunny, crisp fall day, Ishaput Coyote was looking around a lake in search of some flint to make some arrowheads. While he was searching, he ran into some geese. There in the center of the geese was this beautiful young nugatna, a goose girl. He knew right away that he wanted her for his wife. So Ishaput went through his ritual, and he sang his special song to make himself into a nugatna. After changing into a nugatna, he started strutting around in front of the other geese. He wanted the beautiful nugatna girl to notice him. She did notice him and was attracted to him right away. She thought he was such a handsome nugatna. When she told her sister about him, the sister became worried because she'd never seen the handsome nugatna before. Ishaput and the nugatna girl were swimming around together in the lake. He told her that she was so beautiful and that he wanted her for his wife. The young nugatna goose girl was very happy and told him that she wanted to be his wife. The older sister wanted to protect her and was always watching out for her. She told her sister, "You better be careful because that new handsome guy doesn't have the ways of a nugatna, of a goose." She said, "I noticed that when the other geese were eating bugs and grass on the side of the lake, he would sneak off and dig in the dirt for roots and rodents to eat." The young girl didn't listen to her sister's warnings, and she married the handsome nugatna. The next day, the young girl told her new husband, "It's time for us to fly to a new country, where we will stay for the fall and winter." Then she asked him, "Will you fly south with us?" "Yes," he said, and he was very happy to fly with them to a new country. Again, the older sister planned to keep an eye on him, because she didn't trust him, and she wanted to keep her sister safe. The next day, the geese took off. They flew in a V formation towards the south. Ishaput was in the formation line, with the older sister right behind him. By the end of the first day, Ishaput was having a hard time keeping up with the geese. On the second day, he was worn out and struggled to keep flying. By late afternoon, he was really worn out. He started madly flapping his wings, but he couldn't fly straight any longer. He was having a horrible time trying to fly like a goose. Then all of a sudden, his tail feathers flew off. His long, fluffy coyote tail was showing. The older sister called out to her younger sister, "Look at your new husband. He's losing his feathers." By then, his pointed ears were also showing. The wife was scared, and now she knew that she would have to get rid of her husband, because he was not a Nugatna, a goose. She said some magic words and went through a ritual that made him turn back into himself, as Izhiput the coyote. Right then he started falling downward from the sky. They had been flying over some flat country when Izhiput fell to the earth. Then he hit the ground. He hit so hard that it knocked the air right out of him. He was hurt, so he just lay there all night without moving. Then early the next morning when he woke up, he found himself on a desert prairie with lots of sagebrush all around him. To this day, desert prairies covered with sagebrush are one of the places you can find Izhiput the coyote. At night, Izhiput feels sorry for himself, so he mourns and he howls at the moon because he is not a Nugatna, a goose, and because he lost his beautiful Nugatna wife.
You have some very fun illustrations in here. I like the one of the coyote flying as a goose.
My 6-year-old grandson drew that picture.
Oh.
So my family members helped draw all of my illustrations.
I noticed that some were done by Rusty, and that's your uncle, right?
That was my uncle, yes. And he also told a couple of the stories about the horses in the back of the book.
Is there one of those that you'd like to read?
Oh, yes. The Spirit of the Horse, told by Donner Rusty Houts, one of Fort Hall's old-time cowboys. The Boonga, the horse, is one of the best friends to the Indians, Avish. Long ago, the Indians called the Boonga Elk Dog, because when the Indians first saw the Boonga, they thought it was a big soddy, a dog. It had 4 legs, and it grazed like a pataheya, an elk with no antlers. Therefore, they called the horse Elk Dog. Others said that we had a little horse in the very beginning, but they disappeared. From what I was told, the Comanche tribe was once a part of the Shoshone Nation, and they brought the Boonga to us. The Boongas were acquired and spread from tribe to tribe. In the early days before the Boonga, life was very hard. Hunting and gathering food was done on foot. When a camp needed to be moved, heavy bundles were placed on a travois that was dragged by the dogs. So after we got the horse, it brought prosperity, and the threat of starvation was reduced. Since we could go further and faster after game on the horse, the hunts were more successful, and there was more food for everyone. We could go more places, gather more wood, and have more fun, like having horse races with one another. We had enemy tribes that would come from Montana and other states. There was constant warfare. To show your bravery, you would raid horses from the enemy's camps. The enemies would also come to our camp and try to steal our women and our horses. When the white immigrants and the soldiers threatened and came to fight the Indians, we had the Boonga. We were a proud nation, and we had some of the finest horseback warriors that ever lived. The use of riding skills were tested when it came to hunting the Boja, the buffalo. They would ride to a nice meadow where the Boja were grazing, and then they would charge the buffalo. Riders on a full run would ride up on the side of the buffalo and shoot them with a bow and arrow. It was my understanding they would shoot them behind the ribs, and that way their arrow would go right through to the stomach and into the heart. We used every bit of the buffalo to eat. The buffalo would be dragged back to camp for the women to butcher and dry meat for the winter. The buffalo was like going to the Indian supermarket. It provided us with everything. Being able to hunt the buffalo gave us food to eat. The buffalo hides made clothes, robes, drums, and covered teepees. They used to tell me we used everything but the bellow, and I believe we even used the bellow. If you were on this side of the mountain and bellowed like a boja, a buffalo, the other buffalo would come to see what was making the noise. So I think we even used the bellow. Another use of the Boonga was to trade for a wife. A young man would find a beautiful young girl that he wanted to marry, and after he got brave enough, he would go to her father and offer horses. He would tell the father that he loved the girl so much that he would give 2, or sometimes 4, or more horses for her to be his wife. The Boonga, the horse, really helped the Indian people branch out. Like my grandmother's family, they would travel up to the Targhee Pass and Targhee Forest area to hunt and gather food. Then in the winter, they would head down to the Fort Hall bottoms, and they would stay there for the winter months, as they could fish and hunt in that area. The directions they traveled were really linked to the gathering of food. Indian people were always thankful and careful not to take more food than was necessary to feed the people in the camps. They always prayed and had a ceremony to honor and show respect for the plants or animals they used for food. My first time riding the Bunka, the horse, was in the hay fields. My mother would take me out to the field, and I would ride the workhorse back to the barn by hanging onto the hames. They stick up from the leather harness that goes around the horse's neck. I was in Las Vegas talking to one of my friends who was a bulldogging champion, and he said, "Rusty, if we had two more Irishmen at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, we would have won." I laughed and told him, "No, you guys were riding those quarter horses and thoroughbreds, and we had the Appaloosa and the Pinto horse. They were running circles around your army. There's no way you could have won." One of my friends told me the story of the little horse. They said in the beginning we had a little horse, but it disappeared somehow. The little Bunka told the old ones, "Don't forget me. Remember me, because I will be back one day. When I come back, I will be able to run as swift as the wind. I will be strong enough to carry the heavy packs, and I will be sure-footed to climb the mountains for you to hunt." So after hundreds of years, we got the horse back. They say it was the big brother to the little horse.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Donna Houts MacArthur from Fort Hall, Idaho. We're talking about her book titled When the Smoke Goes Straight Up, Grandfather's Stories. We'll continue our conversation and hear more stories from the book right after a short break. Don't go away. I notice you have some other illustrations in here by somebody named Dave.
Yeah, that's my husband. The other illustrator was James Perkins. He's a Choctaw, but he came to Fort Hall because his brother married one of our ladies from Fort Hall. And so he came and said he would like to do some pictures, and so he helped with a few. And the others are my grandsons.
So really the whole family.
Yes.
One of the stories that I really liked was How Music Came to the Indians.
Okay. How Music Came to the Indians. In the beginning, the Indians had no music, no songs, no drums, no rattles or whistles. The animals, the birds, even the trees and other creatures on the Beasogup, Mother Earth, had music. Music was missing from the Indians' lives. This is a story of how music came to the Indians. Avish. Long ago, there was a hunter who was walking in the hills, high among the rocks, looking for a fat yaha, a rock chuck, for supper. As the hunter walked along, the wind came up, blowing dust around him and bending the aspens and the sagebrush tops. The wind made a whispering tune, and the hunter began to hum. Farther on up the hill, the wind blew against the rocks and between the cracks in the ledges, making a moaning and a whistling sound. The hunter tried to make the same sounds. Soon he was humming and singing as he walked along. He became so enchanted with the song he sang, he forgot all about hunting for the yaha, the rock chuck, and returned to the camp empty-handed. As he walked back to camp, he put the words to the song and started singing this song. Breath of the mountains, blow down the valleys, bring joy to the people who live by the river. The hunter sang his song around the evening campfire for the others to hear. They liked the sound of the music and wanted him to teach them the song. Soon everyone was singing this song. Breath of the mountains, blow down the valleys, blow rain into the lowlands and the grass to the prairies. A young woman who lived in the same village by the river was out picking berries. She had her baby on her back in a papoose board. As she was picking berries, she heard the wind singing in the grass and the leaves. She began to hum a song to her baby with the sound she heard. It was a lullaby. Hear the soft rustling, the sigh of the grass and the leaves, singing to the bluebirds, singing a sleeping song. While she sang the song, the baby fell sound asleep on her back. When her bag was filled to the top, she straightened and looked up into the aspen trees that bordered the meadow. The trees rustled in the breeze with a tiny tinkling tune. The young woman listened. Then she sang with the aspens. Breeze from the prairies, leaves from the aspen, mingle together, sing in the sunlight. The young woman returned to camp singing her two songs. That evening she sang them to the others around the campfire. Then as darkness fell over the land, all the people in the village sang the songs they had learned from the wind, the rocks, the trees, and the grass. A few days later, a young brave went upstream to fish. As he walked along, his feet could feel the music of the water. Each ripple sang a song as the creek bounced and gurgled over the stones. Quanda, the crane, began to sing with the stream. Laughter of the water, dancing in the sunlight, sing down the mountains and into the valley. Then the brave went up the creek, catching some nice shiny trout. All through the afternoon he sang the water song. When he returned to the camp in the evening, he sang the song for the others. Now the people had many songs, and they sang them all around the campfire, as embers glowed and faded away. The next morning the chief, who was the wisest person in the village, came out of his teepee just as the sun came up over the mountains. He remembered the songs from the night before. As a meadowlark trilled from the top of the tall sagebrush, he started singing his song, and so was born the morning prayer song. This is a prayer sent to the rays of the rising sun, to Ape, the Great Spirit. Since that time of long, long ago, the Indians have started the day with the morning prayer song. Time passed, and the people added more songs, songs they learned from the birds, the breeze, the sighing pines and the howling wind. They made drums of animal skins and rattles of bones or animal stomachs. With these instruments, they kept time to the music. They began to dance with the sounds of the music. Now, hundreds of years later, whenever Indians gather for powwows, festivals, or when they just want to say thanks to the Creator, they sing and dance with the drums beating loudly, like a heartbeat. That is how music came to the Indians. The rat's tail fell off.
The book not only has stories, but it has language translations. Well, it has a glossary of words, English to Shoshone translation, and then also a glossary of Shoshone to English translation. Are these words that have recently been written down?
That's right. In fact, most of them I'm not sure about the spelling. We do have a Shoshone dictionary, but not all the words that I used was in that dictionary. So a lot of them are just from family members, the way they pronounce it and the way we thought it might be spelled.
Some of these words are a little challenging. I like the squirrel, though. It's called a zeep.
Yes, we can say that one.
Tell me a little bit about when you grew up hearing these stories.
Oh, mostly just when we would gather with the family, nothing special. I mean, it's not like we had a teepee and sat around and told the stories, you know. And my grandfather, when he would gather, well, he liked telling stories. And he liked us to know the history and as much about the tribe as he could remember. And so he had tried to keep us informed.
So this would be an event when your grandfather would come and visit.
It would, yes.
And he would tell you the stories. And then whose job was it to remember them? Your father's, and now it's you?
I think. In fact, my father said he couldn't remember most of them. So and maybe his sisters could, but I don't think he didn't remember a lot of them. Or we could remember how it started and not how it ended, or, you know, so it was probably in the 80s. I thought, I better have my grandfather tell these and try to tape them on the tape recorder. So that's how I got most of them.
I can see why you'd want, why it was really important to you to make a book.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's hard to remember because, and especially if you don't hear them very often. You can remember kind of how it went, but you can't remember all the details. And so like with my grandkids, mostly when they would hear them from me is like if they stayed overnight, I would tell them a bedtime story and it would be one that I could remember. Or maybe if we go camping, we'd take turns trying to tell a story or make up a story. So we'd get their little imaginations working. I just think that it's good to preserve anybody's traditions and their stories and their history. And to me, this was just one way to help preserve some of that.
I know that some tribes have been reluctant to write their stories down. Did that happen with your people?
Yes. In fact, they didn't like the language to be taught to others or the stories to be told to others. They wanted to keep it just with our tribe. But as the years go by, we find that we're losing the language, we were losing the stories. And so I think we came to the conclusion we better start teaching it to our youngsters and to one another so that we don't lose it. And then it's gone forever. Because when our older people die, everything they knew is gone.
I was just so thrilled to see this book because there aren't very many from any of the Western tribes.
Tribes, yeah. Well, it was kind of scary because I didn't know how it would be received. But, you know, nowadays, the kids with their homework read a story at night. Well, I think this would be excellent for our Indian kids to hear our Indian stories. No, we had stories.
Some of the morality stories with the animals killing and eating each other, it was kind of like, holy cow. Like the big mosquito.
Oh, yes.
I thought, this is where the vampire legends come from.
From, yeah. And you know, that happened to be one of my grandkids' favorite. Oh, tell us Mopo, tell us Mopo. They love that story.
That's a story about a huge mosquito that gets turned into a little mosquito by the end of the story, but he was very ruthless.
Yeah.
Coming and just pinning animals down and sucking their
blood out.
So I would imagine the teenagers might like that one.
Yeah.
Donna Houts MacArthur lives on the Shoshone-Bannock Indian Reservation in Fort Hall, Idaho. There's more information about her at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. Also there, links to our podcast, Facebook page, and Huvia Edwards and John Floridas, who wrote and performed the music you heard during this program.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.